12:30 Eastern Wartime. WEAF, New York. Here is Elmer Peterson, NBC war reporter and news analyst, to give you the story behind the latest news. Mr. Peterson.
In military terms, this is D-Day plus one, the second day of the big fight to liberate France. But all day yesterday, radio went across the channel with the invasion troops, recording and transmitting sound pictures of the actual fight. The British Broadcasting Company sent along wire recording machines with two aerial combat units. One, the story of a Canadian transport pilot who flew in his cargo of parachute troops. The second is a recording of those paratroops singing as they are carried by plane toward the great adventure. These sound pictures of the invasion were picked up by NBC this morning via shortwave. They are presented now as another chapter in NBC's complete invasion coverage. And here is the story of the RCAF pilot who flew his paratroop to the coast of France early yesterday.
We ran in to drop our paratroops, going down to less than 1,000 feet. As we made our run over the dropping zone, the flak was scattered. The stick commander, paratroops are treated like a stick of bombs, called the captain of the aircraft, an RCAF man, on the intercom. I have any final instructions. I am taking off my headpiece and putting on my jumping helmet. The captain said, "We're all set now." The stick commander said, "Righto then, good luck." He was an Englishman. The captain said, "Okay, and good luck to you too." Those were the last words we heard on the intercom. After that, you could hear the click of the static line as each parachute was released. We changed course. We couldn't see the men as they were dropped. All we wanted to do then was get the hell out of there. We had done all we could for them, and we headed for base. As we left the dropping zone, the flak increased, and we were hit on one engine. As we crossed the coast, the searchlights caught us. And the pilot started battling the base of action again and got out of that one. Then the motor revved up, and burst into flames, and the prop flew off like a boomerang at a great height. And we got home on what was left. As we came home, we saw other streams of aircraft going out. We realized that we were just a tiny item in a vast shuttle service. We had done our job.
And so D-Day, the day of deliverance, is going well.
And now, if you listen, you'll hear a good old American ballad as sung by paratroopers in their transport plane, en route to the invasion coast sometime early on D-Day.
And so the great adventure began. Our soldiers, British, Canadian, and American, are now fighting on the soil of France. They are the men who a few hours before had set off in a multitude of landing craft from the shores of Britain. These men you now hear singing in this actuality broadcast made in the crowded hold of one of those craft. Setting out for battle, echo the confident words of the man who is now leading them in the field.
And now you'll hear a film recording by George Wheeler, NBC correspondent, from aboard the cruiser Augusta.
This is George Wheeler speaking from the heavy cruiser, United States ship Augusta. It's 3:30 on the morning of Tuesday, June the 6th. Just exactly three. 3 hours before H-hour. H-hour, as you understand, is the moment when the troops hit the beach. This is a curious moment in the lives of men. It's possible at a distance in time and in place to suppose many things, to over-dramatize the situation. You might, for example, think that there would be excessive gaiety among the men. There's not. Or you might, on the other hand, suppose that men would be sitting quietly counting over their secret thoughts. There's not that either. There's an extreme usualness about the behavior of everybody here. I think probably it's because everybody here is well trained. There's nothing amateur about this ship. George Wheeler, speaking from the command ship of the American forces involved in the invasion of France. The order has just been passed to commence firing as soon as we can bear on the target. In just one moment, you are going to know what it sounds like to hear a ship of war fire with you, not more, by microphone, than 20 feet from that battery. It's going to be a blinding flash, just as there are blinding flashes in a battleship not more than 1,000 yards off our port bow. That battleship has been blazing away for the past few moments, for the past, to be exact, 25 minutes, and we have just come into the area where we can bear on the target and where we are also within range of the target. But in this operation, since there are a great many mines in this area, and since by this time, here we go, that was a salvo of 8-inch guns from this heavy cruiser, the Augusta. Another salvo. A third salvo. Ladies and gentlemen of the United States, we are now in business.
You have just heard two recordings by George Wheeler, American broadcast reporter with the United States Navy. We return you now to the United States.
We have just received a report, a Swiss report, quoting sources in German-occupied Milan to the effect that a large Allied fleet has been sighted off Genoa and that a landing on the Ligurian coast of northwestern Italy is expected hourly. There is no confirmation of this report. It must be borne in mind, however, that it is entirely likely. We are now pursuing Kesselring's forces north of Rome. We have landed on the French coast, and there can be no question but what eventually Allied strategy will work into new offensives. There's also a report from London that an Allied armada, this is also a Nazi report received in London, that an Allied armada of more than 100 ships, including battleships, cruisers, destroyers, and landing craft, now are off the French port of Le Havre. Here is an indication from enemy sources of the great extent of the Allied power being assembled to continue the invasion of France. Meantime, from a supreme advance command post of the Allied Expeditionary Force, there comes the announcement that Allied troops have repulsed German counterattacks in the Caen area of France. Caen, as you know, is that important rail and road center on the Paris-Cherbourg line, 115 miles from Paris. This same report from the Supreme Advance Command Post states that all beaches now have been cleared of the enemy, although some, presumably, still are under artillery fire. Some of the beaches, headquarters added, have been linked up with those flanking them. At the same time, Air Force headquarters announced that during the 6 days, from June 1st to last night, Allied air forces flew the stupendous total of 71,000 sorties, a dramatic testimonial to the growing might of Allied air power, the air power which is shielding our land forces in France at this moment. In those 71,000 sorties, many thousand tons of bombs have been dropped. An enormous tonnage, which is indicative not only of Allied might, but also of the power needed to destroy Nazi defenses. Earlier in this program, you were listening to some of NBC's documentary recordings of the news of this historic invasion. The last record was made by George Wheeler, made on a film recorder outfit while aboard the United States cruiser Augusta. And now we have another documentary recording, another NBC exclusive broadcast. This morning, Tom Traynor of the Los Angeles Times came back to London from a European beachhead. We are giving you again his report, as first broadcast about an hour ago over the National Broadcasting Company network.
Please, Ed.
This is the advanced Allied command post of the invasion forces. Part of the amphibious forces which struck at France yesterday were manned by personnel of the United States Coast Guard. Covering them for the combined radio and press global pool was Mr. Tom Traynor, war correspondent of the Los Angeles Times. Mr. Traynor has just arrived at the command post from France after landing on the beachhead with the American Army units that the Coast Guard delivered into battle. He is here in the studio to give you his eyewitness report of the invasion. Mr. Traynor.
I've just returned from France after hitchhiking on 8 ships, mostly Coast Guard. Coast Guard craft seem to be all over the channel, snaking survivors out of the water, rushing wounded to first aid, and landing infantry and vehicles on the beach. I hit the beach myself early during D-Day when the Coast Guard cutter on which I was stationed went close ashore to pull aboard some men who had capsized in a dock. They came aboard shivering and shaking with cold, and as soon as they got below, proceeded to get seasick all over the place. I ceased interviewing them at this point and asked my skipper, Lieutenant Raymond Rosenblum of Baltimore, if he would hail a passing landing craft inward bound to the beach and put me aboard. The transfer was made, and my new skipper, Lieutenant Edward Raymond of Pittsburgh, said, "I don't think we can get in. It's all these obstacles that are messing the thing up before we even get to the beach." I couldn't see any obstacles. "That's the trouble," he said. "Neither can we. The tide is running high and they're covered. Those are heavy posts driven into the sand with booby traps attached. At low tide, we can avoid them. At high tide, you see..." He pointed to various landing craft up and down the beach, which had been stove in and swung idly back and forth with the surf.
"They got us," he said.
We prowled up the coast a mile looking for an opening, and then heard a loud hail behind us. A sleek-looking patrol craft slid by, and the skipper shouted, "Hold off. Don't put your craft ashore until you get further orders." "Now what?" I asked Raymond. "We'll see if we can get you on something smaller," he said. He got out his loudhailer and called a landing craft personnel, which was heading into the beach. Motor machinist mate John Kramer of Albany, New York, and Seaman First Class Jack Whitney of Columbus, Ohio, took me aboard. "Okay," said Kramer to Whitney. "Let's go and keep an eye out for the traps." We came sliding and slewing in on some light breakers and grounded. I stepped ashore on France, walking up a beach where men were moving casually about, carrying equipment inshore. Up the coast a few hundred yards, German shells were pounding in regularly, but in our area, it was peacefully busy. "How did you make out?" I asked one of the men. "It was reasonably soft," he said. "The Germans had some machine gun posts and some high-velocity guns on the palisades and made it a little hot at first. They waited until a landing craft dropped their ramps, then opened up on them while the men were still inside. In a few cases, we took heavy casualties. Then the Navy went to work on the German guns, and it wasn't long before they were quiet." The general lack of fortifications at this point was astonishing. The barbed wire consisted of 4 single strands, such as we use at home defense in cattle. A man could get through by pushing down on one wire and lifting up on another, providing they weren't booby trapped. The engineers and beach battalions, however, had blown gaps in the wire through which we could move vehicles. A few dead lay about, and some wounded were here and there on stretchers awaiting transfer to ships at sea. All up and down the broad beach, as far as I could see, men, jeeps, bulldozers, and other equipment were moving about like ants. A few columns of black, greasy smoke marked equipment which had been hit by shell fire and set afire. The German shelling continued steadily at various points up and down the beach, but so far not reached the area in which I was walking. It would work over an area, then move on to another. It was accurate, landing for the most part close to the water's edge, and I saw one small landing craft catch fire after taking a hit. Men came spilling out of it into water waist deep. From time to time, there were huge concussions as the engineers set off demolitions. The The ground would shake, and the troops would throw themselves violently on the ground. I climbed a rock embankment and came to a piece of flat land where hundreds of men were digging foot trenches. When they got down about a foot and a half, they struck water. Some of them were lying in the water, and I asked if there was much shelling. "There is when there is," one man said. "Right now there isn't, but when it comes, it sure comes." I asked him what German fortifications he could point out. He showed me some tunnels at the top of the palisade. Palisade rises above the beach along this stretch of coast. There were five or six positions I could make out, nothing particularly formidable. I walked over to an aerial which seemed to mark a command post. A colonel and a major were sitting beside a split trench half filled with water, and I said to the colonel, "Sir, I'm a war correspondent." He looked up from a map fiercely, and the major said, "I think you'd better stop back later. You might try going up that path there where you see those men. If you can make it, watch out for mines. It's heavily mined." A long column of men was winding up the palisade on a narrow path. They weren't moving. At the skyline, they seemed to be knotted up. To reach the palisade, I joined a column who were wading across a slough. The water came nearly to their armpits, and they had to hold their rifles and equipments over their heads. The water was rather warm, but the bottom was a slimy mess. When a man got to the far side of the slough, he would always stop in a maddening way, holding the rest of us up. We shouted angrily, but when we got there, each one of us stopped too. The reeds on the far bank were loaded with mines. One man lay at the top of the bank dead. The mines had been marked with bits of paper, and soldiers at the top advised just how to climb so as not to venture into dangerous ground. There were more dead men along the narrow path which led up the palisade. The column had stopped moving, and I began to step past men following a captain. Suddenly a voice said, "Watch yourself, fellow, that's a mine." A soldier sprawled on the bank was speaking. He had one foot half blown off. He'd stepped on a mine a short time earlier. Now, while he waited for litter bearers, he was warning other soldiers about other mines in that vicinity. I can stand the dead, but the wounded horrify me, and I only looked at him to thank him. He looked very tired, but perfectly collected. "What you need is the medic," I said. "I'll try and get them for you when I go back down." "Yeah," he said, "but how are they going to get up here?" He was right. The pathway was so clogged with men and so heavily mined that it was impassable. The engineers would have to get up there first. The column didn't move forward. The captain I was following stopped, and so did I. I asked him his name, and he said he was Louis Hilly of Cincinnati. "It looks like they shell around here a bit," I said, pointing to some shallow craters. "No," said Hilly, "those are all mines. That's why we're stuck on this path." We tried to edge a few feet further forward and came to a soldier lying in the path, curled around a mine. He said his name was Private Morton Soratello of the Bronx. And I asked him if it didn't make him nervous to be curled around a mine like that. "No," he said, "I just keep clear of it and pass the word on to those behind." Just ahead of him, Second Lieutenant Bernard Flynn of Springfield, Massachusetts, and Sergeant Arthur Brown of Brookfield, Maryland, were sitting in the immediate vicinity of mines, which they were calling to attention of all who passed. "It's all right, except when a shell comes in," Flynn said. "Then you're apt to forget and fall on the thing." While we were stopped there, a squib-like report sounded behind us. I thought it was a mortar going off. But Captain Hilly said it was a mine. He'd heard enough of them this day. At the top of the palisade, the knot of men had gotten to its feet, and it looked like the line might move. One man darted over the skyline, and almost immediately afterwards, we heard the speedy burst of a German machine gun. Then a few stray rifle shots. The bullets cracked overhead, and everyone instinctively ducked lower. These were some troops who had never seen combat before, and the bullets must have seemed close to them, although we were 100 feet below the skyline. The line remained stationary, and I looked down the beach and the sea. Landing craft of all descriptions were sliding in through the low surf, disgorging men who moved through the water with amazing alacrity. As soon as they got ashore and saw the men moving about calmly, they seemed to steady down and began to walk quietly themselves. I waited a spell longer, and the line didn't move, so I began to make my way down the path again. It was slow work. The soldiers were so alarmed that I would step on a mine right next to them, and one man told me to walk on his back rather than step off the path. I promised I would try and get the engineers up to disarm the mines. While I was going down the slope, the Germans began shelling our area. It was hard not to throw myself on the ground willy-nilly, but the thought of those mines kept me from it. The shells were still landing at some distance on the flat. I took a last look at the greatest armada in history before going on the flat. It was too immense to describe.
You have been listening to a recorded eyewitness account by Tom Trainer of Los Angeles on his return from an Allied beachhead. He was introduced by Merrill Muller. And now here's Don Hollenbeck.
In a special broadcast from London a few minutes ago, NBC reporter W.W. Chaplin gave us a well-rounded report on our progress in France. And Bill reports it is progress. Chaplin says the enemy has been cleared from our beachheads. But better than that, Some of those beachheads along the Normandy coast have already been linked up, consolidated. To quote Bill, all the French beaches on which Allied troops have landed have been cleared of the enemy. I was just given that assurance in the great map room of the Ministry of Information, where the walls are covered not only with maps of the invasion area, but also with photographic likenesses of Allied leaders and enemy leaders, von Rundstedt, Rommel, and Goering. Chaplin reports that this is a great day in the air, too. The forces may even surpass yesterday's record of 13,000 sorties, flights by individual planes. Well, that's the bright side of the picture, and as Bill says, no wonder the Allied communique reports satisfactory progress. But on this second day of invasion, known in that map room as D+1, Allied leaders are putting another note besides optimism in their voices, a note of caution, Chaplin reports. We get that warning, too, from our NBC reporter George Wheeler, who's in the channel now with the American Navy. As George says, we're in business on the continent and carrying the business through. But as in every business, there are two columns in the ledger, one for profit and one for loss. There will be loss in this invasion business, too. No use blinking that fact, Chaplin told us in that special broadcast from London a few moments ago. We'd only be fooling ourselves if we did. There are so many things known as imponderables, things over which generals and admirals have no control. Weather is the big imponderable. Bill says it was better this morning, better than on D-Day, but then it closed in again. The latest word Chaplin had before his broadcast was that there were heavy clouds over much of the small area that can be used for landings in France. Returning pilots also reported some icing up as they flew through the upper levels of those clouds. And nature isn't the only obstacle, Chaplin says. The Germans can by no means be discounted because they haven't yet mounted any major counterattacks. Their resistance is increasing. Some of those coastal guns, which were thought to have been knocked out in the initial attack, have been in action again this morning, and the Luftwaffe has been showing some signs of life, Bill says, and the ground fighting is heavy. In fact, now this is another enemy report received in London and relayed by Bill Chaplin in a special broadcast from London a few moments ago. Massed formations of German reserves are attacking our forces with what the German Overseas Agency calls terrific ferocity in Normandy. The Germans claim our losses have already mounted to several divisions, undoubtedly an exaggeration on the familiar German pattern, but losses there have unquestionably been, Chaplin says, and there will be more. Finally, while German air resistance is on a small scale so far, Allied leaders in England admit that it's increasing. The Luftwaffe laid low in the early hours of the invasion, a natural thing to do with the skinny resources at Goering's command. Now that skinny reserve is being used for the German high command figures it will count the most. There's simply no telling what the strength of the German air force in the West is. With all the battering of production and the heavy losses in the air, it must have shrunk to a minuscule figure put beside the stunning 11,000 airplanes that the Allies can draw on. The most optimistic guess at the time the Luftwaffe was in its flower didn't put its strength above 5,000 or 6,000 planes. If there are 1,000 now available for use on the Western Front, the German Air Force is in better shape than they have any right to be. So we can be sure that wherever Goering uses the Luftwaffe, he will use it to the best advantage. Although just here, there's no such thing as an imponderable. 11,000 airplanes is a lot of airplanes, and the Luftwaffe is engaged in a hopeless fight, although it may be a fight full of bitterness and tricks while it lasts. Now I'm going to repeat a bulletin that was brought to you a few moments before by Elmer Peterson. Here it is, a bulletin from Zurich, Switzerland. Unconfirmed reports from German-occupied Milan say that a large Allied fleet has been sighted off Genoa. The supposition is that a landing will be made on the Ligurian coast of northwestern Italy. There is, however, no confirmation of this report, and it has not been received from any other source. I repeat, Zurich, Switzerland, hears from German-occupied Milan that a large Allied fleet has been sighted off Genoa. The Zurich dispatch adds that a landing on the Ligurian coast of northwestern Italy is expected hourly. And here's a bulletin from Stockholm. Dispatches from Berlin report today that the Allies landed several divisions along the Seine Bay of the Normandy coast and by noon had consolidated their Orne River Bayou bridgehead. In other words, Berlin has now confirmed the Allied news of consolidating beachheads, that maneuver that's so important in a landing, reported by W.W. Chaplin in a broadcast from London, which we have gone over for you just now.
Thank you, Don Hollenbeck. Keep tuned to this station for further invasion bulletins. This is the National Broadcasting Company. WEAF, New York.